WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Wednesday, April 26th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Here are the stories we're following today. So Washington State Governor Jay Inslee signed a trio of anti-gun bills yesterday, one of which immediately bans the manufacture, buying, or importation of so-called assault weapons. House Bill 1240 bans the popular AR-15 and other semi-automatic rifles. Here's a Washington State firearm store owner discussing the sad development.
The state used to be one of the best states for gun rights in the country. If this law goes into effect and the judge doesn't stay it or throw it out because of the constitutionality of it, then we will by far be the worst state in this country for firearms rights. We won't even have a close second. Going from one of the best to one of the worst. That all happened in 7 years. So it can, those things can change quickly. Anytime there's a one-party state that can pass whatever they want, whatever comes to their mind, they can actually put through. The people that have taken office have sworn and they've taken actually a pledge to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not the parts that they like and not the parts that they don't like. They have an agenda, and that agenda is to get rid of all guns, and eventually all guns.
Washington State-based Second Amendment Foundation has already filed a federal lawsuit over the legislation, claiming it criminalized the fundamental right to self-defense. The Firearm Industry Trade Association is also vowing a lawsuit. Washington now joins 9 other states that have banned AR-style rifles. That's California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, as well as the District of Columbia. Do you notice a common theme there? These are states run by people who either don't understand the concept of liberty or violate it on purpose. These are states whose leaders push the boot of COVID tyranny extra hard on the neck of its citizens, and these are the states that people are fleeing. Nearly every argument anti-gunners make is lies or ignorant drivel.
I've held an AR-15 in my hand. I wish I had it. It is as heavy as 10 boxes that you might be moving. And the bullet that is utilized, a 50 caliber, these kinds of bullets, need to be licensed and do not need to be on the streets.
That's Representative Sheila Jackson of Texas discussing the Unicorn AR, one that shoots 50 caliber bullets and is as heavy as 10 moving boxes. Here's another Democratic legislator, this one from Florida, saying an AR shoots hundreds of rounds a minute.
And he was not able to buy a weapon that shoots off 700 rounds in a minute.
We can do an entire show on ridiculously ignorant things leftists have said about firearms and violence committed by people with firearms, and maybe one day we will. And speaking of ignorance, the so-called Tennessee Three visited President Biden on Monday to strategize about gun confiscation. The three Tennessee state lawmakers, Justin Jones, Justin Pearson, and Gloria Johnson, catapulted to national fame after inciting a mob of anti-gun activists to shout down legislators inside the Tennessee State House. Passions have been running amok in Tennessee after the mass shooting in a Nashville private Christian school last month. As a result of their actions, two of the three, Jones and Pearson, were expelled from the legislature, while Johnson survived removal by a single vote. Jones and Pearson were immediately reinstated by their respective electorates. They have since continued stirring up anger against Republicans for their supposedly racially motivated actions. After the meeting with Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, Johnson told reporters outside the White House that we talked about red flags, we talked about safe storage gun laws, we talked about assault weapons and what that would look like. GOP U.S. Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee wasn't impressed with the president politicizing the latest mass shooting.
You know, I understand that this White House is focused entirely on politics. I'm certainly focused on the Covenant Six, those who lost their lives. We're doing what we can to put in place legislation to harden schools, to protect these children, to protect the most vulnerable. And political stunts really are secondary in mind, I think, to everyone, certainly in Tennessee, that cares about the situation at Covenant School.
Biden told the three during the meeting that they're standing up for our kids, our communities, and get this, democratic values. And in related news, demand that federal officials release the trans Nashville shooter's manifesto is growing. Many suspect that the woke pro-trans Department of Justice is intentionally withholding the evidence because it might make so-called transgender people look bad. The FBI reportedly found 20 journals, 5 laptops, and a suicide note at the murderer's home. All have been completely concealed from the public so far. Senator Bill Hagerty told Fox News he was frustrated by the delays.
Also, just real quick on the shooter, the manifesto they say is too dangerous to release. What can you tell us about that? I'd love to know the motive of the killer.
It's been very perplexing to all of us involved. It seems that certain information is flooded into the marketplace immediately if it fits the narrative, so to speak. If the information does not fit the narrative, it seems to get suppressed. I don't know what's in the manifesto. I want to be sensitive to our law enforcement officers that are going through this, but it's certainly taken a long time to figure out whether and what information can be released. Yeah. I think people do deserve to know what took place, what was in the mind of this sick person that committed these heinous murders.
Some Nashville officials believe the manifesto will never be released to the public in its entirety, with Metro Nashville Council member Courtney Johnson calling it a blueprint on total destruction and astronomically dangerous. And shifting to a saner perspective, Texas school districts continue hiring armed private marshals to protect schools, with San Marcos School District near Austin the latest to change its policy. The movement has gained momentum in the wake of the devastation caused by the mass school shooting last year at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, which left 19 students and 2 teachers dead. As one concerned citizen pointed out at the recent San Marcos School Board meeting, hundreds of guns were in Uvalde, hundreds, and none of them did the job, at least not soon enough. School marshals are required to have 80 hours of training and pass a psychological exam. So my colleague here, Steve Bonta, joins me, who's senior editor of The New American. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Paul.
So, you know, I was thinking about those that footage with Sheila Jackson and the legislator from Florida, and I was wondering if they are so used to not getting caught for the lies or the deception that they tell that they didn't think it didn't occur to them that people would know that they're lying about ARs, right? Like as heavy as 10 boxes, shooting 50 caliber. The other guy's saying these things shoot 700 rounds. They either don't know or they're lying, but one way or another, it's like I think they're just so used to lying, they don't realize that sometimes people know what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, where gun rights are concerned, the thought that was going through my head, and by the way, I think that most of them are just ignorant. Some of them, of course, willfully lie. But when they make these idiotic comments about these mythical properties of ARs and other types of weapons that they would dearly love to proscribe, it's out of profound ignorance. These people have never fired an AR. They have no perceived need of a gun for any kind of personal security because they enjoy the comforting cocoon of security guards mm-hmm. and all the other perks that public figures and otherwise the wealthy and well-connected enjoy. So there's that. But, you know, the larger issue to me and the really concerning thing is how significant now appear to be the swaths of this country where the spirit that animated our noble forebears, not just the founding fathers, but, you know, the vast majority of the people who built this country up is lost. I mean, the spirit of, you know, I know it's cliche to say this, but rugged individualism, but of which, you know, gun ownership is a major part. It's just astonishing, having lived in countries where gun ownership is completely prohibited and seeing the way that people are forced to grovel before the state and endure just unfathomable indignities and impositions. It's mind-boggling to me that America, I mean, so-called gun rights, which I think probably is maybe not a sufficient term, is one of the great distinctives of American culture, of the American legal system, and it's being taken away before our very eyes. I mean, do we really want to imitate the countries, you know, the Chinas of the world and the European nations, where at best gun ownership is a tightly circumscribed privilege where, yeah, you can own a gun, but you have to keep it at the gun range or the gun club, and you can only go and it's under lock and key.
Yeah.
You know, but the idea that mere mundanes, as my late colleague Will Grigg used to refer to them, were worthy of owning guns for self-protection is just, in so many sectors, has disappeared. And the irony is, it seems to be particularly prevalent among Black politicians.
Yeah.
Black Americans of all people
should know
the consequences, since the first gun control and gun confiscation acts were directed at them to prevent them from being armed and being able to resist the mobs in the South during Reconstruction and the Jim Crow period and so forth and so on.
No, that's a good point.
I mean, the reason for all those lynchings that you see, those old grainy black and white pictures of, you know, Black people being hung by lynch mobs, you know, 120 years ago or whatever in the Deep South, is they couldn't own weapons.
Yeah, they couldn't defend
themselves.
There
was no way they could defend themselves.
Yeah. I've had this conversation with R2A for today, host Zoe Warren, you know, who is Black and who's down in South Carolina, and he agrees the same thing. But this is a little depressing, but as we've reported recently too, is that gun ownership has grown. And despite, I guess it doesn't make sense to me, because what we're seeing in Washington and these other states doesn't really jive with the national numbers. And especially during the summer of 2020, with the riots, gun ownership just skyrocketed. It just skyrocketed, and people realize what gun advocates have been saying for years is that police aren't always going to be there to protect you. But like you say, we don't even need that excuse. This is a right. This should be a right. And people should realize. And I know that sometimes they'll make the argument will be that, well, you can have guns, you just can't have ARs. And we know that's not the case. And we know that they're so ignorant, because they say...
Just look at Canada.
Yes.
This is the road Canada went down. And now the Canadians are effectively barred. When I last visited Canada, it was still not uncommon for Canadians to own SKSs and AR-15s and so forth. They were able to, you know, handguns, but of course they restricted even then the size of the magazine. You couldn't have a handgun with more than 10 rounds in the magazine. This was true, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Now, basically all semi-automatic handguns in Canada are banned. I think most revolvers are either banned or very hard to get.
Anything other than development, right?
It's very recent under Justin Trudeau, of course, who is basically an anti-gun tyrant, among many other things. And so the Canadians have watched, you know, almost all of their firearms gobbled up by the Trudeau administration just in the last 3 years. Okay, and of course, and it was so blatant that, you know, they openly lied about what they were doing. They indicated in private, they listed like several thousand different types of rifles, including many that didn't even look scary.
Yeah.
You know, that were just, you know, fired more than one bullet without being able to I don't know what it was, but like thousands of makes were banned almost overnight. And then they lied about it to the Canadian public. And so they've criminalized probably millions of Canadians. Canada does have a robust hunting tradition, and a lot of Canadians do cherish the right to keep and bear arms.
There's
but
good
look where it's going.
There.
And that is exactly what's going to happen here unless people stand up to this mob. It's absolutely unconscionable what's
going on. And I think it's also telling, though, that while some states are doing this, other states, as we mentioned, for instance, Texas is going the opposite, the saner direction, which is like, oh, well, clearly we must arm these. I think one thing that people don't understand, and one of these talking points, and that's why we reported, so much of this is deceptive. They lie and they lie and they lie and they lie. If you look at areas where they have gun, the strictest gun control measures, that's where the crime rate is highest.
Well, yes.
Yeah, but then they'll try to tell you, it's like, well, if you look at Australia and you look at this, first of all, that's a lot of that is misdirection and deception. But secondly, there is a factor in America that is not applicable anywhere else. That being that there is such an overabundance of firearms, banning them from law-abiding citizens is not going to get rid of them. They're not going to disappear. They're not going to go into the air, and the criminals are still going to have them. every argument that they make is deceptive, is ignorant, or is just straight up lies. It does not measure up with reality.
Well, you know, here's the bleak reality. It's been shown in the past, you know, and there's that old meme that says, you know, the experts agree gun control works, and there's pictures of, you know, Mao and Stalin, Hitler, and so forth. Oh, yeah, you can do that. And what you'd have to do in the United States would be the same thing that was done in, you know, in China, in the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, and so all these other places, okay? And that is you'd have to go out and kill millions of people. You'd have to have a horrible, you know, civil war type situation. You'd have to go out there ruthlessly massacre, you know, tens of millions of Americans and so forth. And yeah, I suppose if enough people were on the wrong side, I mean, that would be an awful outcome. But sure, I mean, this is how, I mean, you know, I've actually lived in overseas in countries where there are
totalitarian states.
In totalitarian states, and it's taken them literally centuries to get to the point. And it doesn't stop with guns either. This is something people don't understand, that hoplophobic, you know, totalitarian regimes also confiscate knives, swords, bows and arrows, crossbows, even tools and implements that might be usable as a weapon are often modified in various ways. Just amazing.
Did they confiscate the samurai sword in Japan?
Oh, sure, sure.
Because they wanted to disarm the warrior.
Absolutely. So it's not just gun confiscation. It's broader. It's total disarmament. And to do that, you know, you need to have a period, a reign of terror, in effect, followed by generations and generations and generations of propaganda telling people it's wrong to own guns and so forth. Then eventually you get to the point where, you know, a country like China or so forth, where the populace is indeed totally cowed and just can't fathom the idea of people actually owning firearms anymore. And as a result, they exist at the whim of their overlords.
Yeah. People better wake up, man. People better wake up, because that's what they're doing. They're brainwashing and they're cowing enough people to go along with it. Thank you, Steve. Stay tuned, folks, because we'll be right back to discuss an important story you're unlikely to have heard anywhere else. We'll be right back.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back. And let's look at our last story, after which New American investigative journalist William F. Jasper will join us. Palantir Technologies was launched in 2003 as a joint venture of billionaire techie Peter Thiel and the CIA. Thiel chipped in $30 million and the CIA, operating through its venture capital arm InQtel, reportedly put up $2 million. Few Americans probably know that the CIA has an outfit called InQtel, and fewer still realize it has been very busy financing tech startups with their tax dollars for more than two decades. But the $2 million InQtel invested in Palantir is only part of the Thiel CIA story. The mega-rich Thiel didn't need InQtel's relatively paltry sum of taxpayer money. Nope. The partnership involved much more than that. Unsurprisingly, the details are spy world murky, but the deal involved close collaboration between Palantir's Palo Alto geeks and Langley's scientists, spooks, and technicians. During its early years, the CIA was not only Palantir's patron, but also its only customer. With CIA's help, however, Palantir's investor pool swelled dramatically. It has catapulted to the top of the artificial intelligence dogpile, particularly as it pertains to the kind of massive data mining necessary for the Orwellian total surveillance state. You know, like the one they have in communist China with their omnipresent video cameras and microphones for their social credit system. This is especially concerning since Palantir's customer base now includes major intelligence, military police, commercial, medical, and financial organizations, including the CIA, FBI, DIA, NSA, DHS, U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Army, U.S. Navy, U.S. Marine Corps, U.S. Space Force, Federal Health and Human Services, the New York Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, and the New Orleans Police Department. Palantir technology is being used by the good guys to go after the bad guys, right? But technology is a double-edged sword. It can also be used by bad guys in and out of government to go after the good guys. One might think, or at least want to think, that Palantir technology is safe in the hands of Peter Thiel, who is an outspoken libertarian. But the partnership between Thiel's Palantir and the CIA is concerning, to say the least. And this relationship is just part of interlocking connections between big tech, big government, and the deep state and its intelligence apparatus. So joining us today to discuss this matter is New American senior editor William F. Jasper. William, Mr. Bill Jasper, how are you?
Doing fine, Paul. Great to be back with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. It's an honor to have you. And I understand that you're working on something a little longer, somewhat of a deep dive into this for the New American magazine there. I wanted to ask you first, this does seem like a curious partnership, at least on the surface, you know, between supposedly Thiel, who I guess on the, you know, doesn't seem like that type. But what do you make of that, the partnership between Thiel, a libertarian, and the surveillance state that is just continues to grow?
Well, it's very concerning, alarming even. And so this has been developing for a number of years now. And this has given Thiel and Palantir a big boost in the AI artificial intelligence scramble, because they have now, using all this sophisticated AI that they have developed with the CIA, now have spread out over all of the various agencies that you mentioned, as well as corporate America, all of the big banks, most of the big banks, many of the big corporations, Microsoft, etc., using Palantir to basically surveil everything. Peter Thiel is a big fan of J.R. Tolkien. He names a lot of his business ventures after Tolkien characters or Tolkien features. And taking the term Palantir, he, you know, wants to be able to see everything. And
yeah.
What they are doing now is creating an even bigger collaboration with the federal government. Peter Thiel, together with Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google and of Alphabet, have gone together and formed another company called the America's Frontier Fund to push for more federal involvement, more government money for technology development, particularly for the development of semiconductors, very advanced semiconductors that can do all of these tech crunching, data crunching type of things. And Eric Schmidt and Thiel are both, of course, billionaires, but they are also both globalists. Thiel gives an impression of being a nationalist. He supported Trump. He has supported many other conservative congressional candidates. But he's been buying his way into influence in the Republican Party. And he has gone together with Schmidt, who is doing the same thing in the Democrat Party. Schmidt is a big, was a big funder and bundler and tech advisor and promoter for Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden. And he has a very big footprint now in the Biden administration, particularly in the science, Office of Science Technology, where he basically controls that with his people. So they went together and created this Frontier Fund to lobby in Congress for that. And who did they choose for their CEO? You mentioned in the opening here, In-Q-Tel, that's the CIA's venture capital arm that funds all of these tech startups. Well, they got Gilman Louie, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who was the man who started up In-Q-Tel for the CIA, to come over and run their new fund. So they've just scored a big success yesterday. It was announced by the Biden administration that they were putting up $11 billion for this new National Semiconductor Center, which is really fascist industrial policy, where the government decides, okay, we're going to take money from the taxpayer, and we're going to reward these certain corporations that have mm-hmm. political connections here. And of course, Peter Thiel and Eric Schmidt are right there in the forefront of that. They are both also, as I point out in my article on this, they are both members of the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group, which is, of course, the kind of the ultimate secret society at the top of the globalist cabal. They were also both brought into that environment through the global young leaders of the World Economic Forum. So they, along with many of the other people that like Sergey Brin and Larry Page, all of these other Silicon Valley people have come up through this young global leaders of the World Economic Forum. So that does, and we know, we've written a lot about the World Economic Forum, their Great Reset. As all of these guys get more and more their talons into the tech sector and government policy being merged with it, that is precisely what the Great Reset is all about, this whole globalist plan. So it's not a good thing. And it's particularly concerning that yesterday when this was announced, Senator Ted Cruz came out and he gave a speech lobbying to have this new center built in Texas. Rather than opposing this, as
he wants, you know, it in his state. Yeah. What is the supposed benefit of this? Because we hear surveillance and we automatically think that this is not a good thing. Is it just simply as that this is to prevent and to watch terrorists and everyone else who has nothing else to worry about? Is that what their oppressor would say on this?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the Palantir is run by a guy that that Thiel hired, who comes out and says that, yes, we're very concerned about privacy. This could go wrong if it's used by the wrong people for the wrong purposes.
Like,
and
the
so
CIA?
He and Schmidt and whatnot say that is why we need to have the government come in, and we need to all work this together, because then we'll work it out so that there are ethics rules and things. We've seen a lot of other things like that. Doesn't seem to come out so well, particularly mm-hmm. when we have all of these deep state actors in the CIA, DIA, FBI, etc., who are going to be the ones in government, who are going to be working with their colleagues in the deep state, big tech. That's not a very consoling thought.
No, that is interesting. It's interesting. You would think Peter Thiel, if he is who he supposedly is, he would realize that the CIA is the last organization that you want to empower, that you want to help build better capabilities for surveillance. I guess I don't understand it, and maybe we should probably do something a little deeper in the Peter Thiel later on. But can you?
I have something on that coming up.
Do you? Okay, that's terrific. I think our audience would love to hear that, and I'm excited. We'll definitely have to have you back on because I think a lot of people are a little curious now. What's the deal with this guy? With the few remaining minutes that we have, do you have any specifics on the capabilities that are being developed and what this would look like? Are we talking about, you know, street cameras? Are we talking about better algorithms for red flagging and things like that? What's coming out of this? Do you have any idea?
All of the above and more. So, you know, in I mentioned in there, in its promotional materials to law enforcement and intelligence, it Palantir boasts that it has helped its system, which is used by the New York Police Department, allows the NYPD to search 500 million, half a billion license plates in 5 seconds. So that's pretty impressive. Yeah. If you saw the CBS miniseries Person of Interest, where Jim Caviezel and a tech wizard hunt down baddies, it covers just about everything. Anything that takes place, things that you buy, any of your commercial transactions. Video cameras, which are omnipresent, microphones, which are omnipresent, your school records, health records, military records, criminal records, all of those are merged and instantly accessed by AI. So, yes, it is the ultimate panopticon. Panopticon, Jeremy Bentham's futurist thing about the way in which we be able to keep constant surveillance on a prisoner in a prison. This makes that possible in our daily lives. A matrix, if you would.
Yeah, yeah. It's very concerning. And what I find odd is that these types of these operations, these developments of surveillance, there doesn't ever seem to be any elements of it that comes up for a vote. They just develop these things, and then they just start using them. And I find that very odd. I thought about it while you're talking. It's like, we never got a say in this. The CIA just decided to do it like they decided to do so many other things. We look forward to on your piece on what we find out about Peter Thiel. And thank you, Bill Jasper, investigative reporter, a senior editor for The New American. You can find a whole lot by Bill at thenewamerican.com.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, folks, that's all for our news segment today. And for more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. And stay tuned, because after this, The New American's Rebecca Terrell interviews U.S. Representative Andrew Clyde of Georgia about his work in Congress, after which Robert Owens discusses jury nullification. See you on the other side.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Next up, The New American's Rebecca Terrell interviews U.S. Representative Andrew Clyde of Georgia about his work in Congress. Let's check this out.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rebecca Terrell with The New American Magazine. With me today in the spotlight is U.S. Representative Andrew Clyde of Georgia, one of the very few true statesmen we have today on Capitol Hill. Congressman Clyde, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, Rebecca, thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you've earned an enviable 90% score on our Freedom Index, which is the New American's congressional scorecard based on the U.S. Constitution. You're pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, and in the current Congress, you've been assigned to the House Appropriations Committee. Congratulations on that. And we're going to talk about all of these issues and more. But first, I want to zero in on your first experience in the current Congress. You made headlines in January as one of the Republicans who stalled its start for voting for Andy Biggs of Arizona as Speaker of the House. And incidentally, Congressman Biggs boasts a 100% score on our Freedom Index, so I admire your taste. But later, you threw your support behind Kevin McCarthy, who actually only earned a 74% Freedom Index score recently. And you tweeted that you voted for McCarthy based on an agreement to a framework that creates significant historical institutional change. Can you walk us through your thinking on that vote?
Absolutely, I can. And that was the whole thing. It was not about personalities. It was about fixing a broken Congress. Because when I got to Congress, and even before I got there, you could see the Congress was broken. And a great example of that is just look at how many Republicans voted for the $1.7 trillion omnibus back in December. And so, you know, this was an opportunity. It was the right place. It was the right time. It was the right fight. It was the speaker's race where we could actually get agreement from the speaker, the new potential speaker, on transformational institutional change in Congress. Some of the things that Nancy Pelosi had eliminated, you know, were going to stay eliminated if we didn't do something. And so we pressed our case and we just said, we're not going to vote for anyone who doesn't believe in these fundamental things. One was the 200-year-old Jeffersonian rule, the motion to vacate, which allows one member of Congress to declare the chair to be empty and therefore hold the speaker accountable. Also, we required 72 hours from the time a bill is introduced before it can be voted on the House floor. What that does is it prevents these backroom deals that we have seen time and time and time again, where you have all, you know, the omnibus is a great example of them. We just had a few hours to read a 4,000-page bill. And, you know, those kind of things are not acceptable. Members have to be able to have input. And, you know, part of the deal was single subject bills. Another one was an open amendment process that allows every member of Congress to have their input into a bill that comes to the House floor. And then you had to have the rules in place to make that happen and the guardrails to ensure the rules were adhered to and were not just waived. And so these things were critical things that were necessary for me to vote for a speaker. You know, I just wanted, you know, the person or the rules that would keep the person accountable. And that's what ended up happening. You know, it took us 4 days. I mean, wasn't planning on it being that long, but, you know, that's okay. That was all right.
That's what it takes, right? Yeah.
Right, right. Exactly. I mean, this is the way a constitutional republic operates. And
that's right.
And it was pretty amazing to see on the House floor. It looked like, I think CNN, or not CNN, but C-SPAN got its highest ratings ever during those 4 days when people across the country were glued to the television to see what would happen. And, you know, I'm encouraged. Speaker McCarthy has done very well. I think that he has embraced these rules. And I think so far he's governing in accordance with them, helping move the Republican conference ahead and really help us stay unified because that's the way we're going to accomplish things. And
right.
I'm really excited about it, and I'm glad.
That's wonderful. Then there's hope for California after all, right?
Well, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, too, about your appointment to the House Appropriations Committee. It's, of course, not hard to tell what your objective is going to be there since you voted not only against that omnibus spending bill that you mentioned, but the Inflation Reduction Act as well last year. So, you know, what's your plan for saving the country from financial ruin? Do we have hope?
We do have hope, you know, and part of the guardrails to ensure the rules are you know, that were agreed to are followed, is having more conservatives on those important committees that can, at the very beginning, influence the bill in such a way that all the rest of the conservatives will be able to vote for the bill when the bill gets to the House floor. So having solid conservatives on those important committees, like appropriations, was one of the agreements. You know, it wasn't necessarily me, but I was the one I fought for it, and I got the position. But one of the agreements was that we move back to FY22 funding levels for FY24. That immediately saves $130 billion. And then a limit of 1% increase for the next decade, 1% per year for the next decade. I mean, those are actual cuts. Those are not reductions of increases. Those are actual cuts to spending to help put us on a path back to a balanced budget. And that's what is so important. And that's why, as an appropriator, I will get to say, I'll have a vote on what the money that goes toward the authorizations for each and every agency in the federal government. And when you have conservatives that are fiscal conservatives and that are very frugal on the Appropriations Committee, you are going to make sure we get the best bang for our buck, and that the federal government is not supersized, but gets as skinny as possible.
Absolutely. We need a little bit more of that thinking, don't we? Well, now let's shift gears and talk briefly about your work in defense of the Second Amendment. I know you're a gun shop owner, and in the last Congress, you voted against the assault weapons ban, which would make it illegal to own, sell, or knowingly possess a semi-automatic weapon or large capacity ammunition feeding device. And of course, last month, you introduced a Congressional Review Act to prevent Biden's ATF from enforcing an unconstitutional pistol brace rule. So walk us through your thinking on bills like this, on how anti-gun radicals label these with the inflammatory term assault weapons, and also what's your take on these red flag laws in light of the Nashville school shooting in March?
Well, I'll tell you, there's no need for red flag laws. Red flag laws actually limit a person's due process of law. There are laws in place without red flag laws that allow people to be committed to mental institutions, those that are mentally unstable or have gender dysphoria or things like that. You know, those are mental issues, and we have laws in place already to take care of that. They just have to be enforced and followed. But the Second Amendment is so absolutely vital to our Constitution and preserving life and liberty in the United States, because without the Second Amendment, there's no teeth to make sure we have a First Amendment. The First Amendment is the most important. The ability to speak, the ability to express your views, to bring your grievances to the government. But without a Second Amendment, those First Amendment rights will go away. But the Second Amendment is what keeps us free. And, you know, as a gun shop owner, one of our motto is we enable individual participation in the preservation of liberty. That's what the Second Amendment really does right there. And so I will be a staunch supporter, a defender of the Second Amendment in everything I do. I've introduced numerous pro-Second Amendment bills in the House, and I will defend the Second Amendment at every turn. To make sure that we don't lose that ability to defend ourselves individually and defend against a tyrannical government that wants to take away our liberties, because that's what we're seeing time and time again from the liberal left.
Absolutely, we are. And another area that you are a staunch defender is the pro-life front, which there's a lot going on right now in that arena. I know last year you voted against the Women's Health Protection Act, and that would have established healthcare providers would have a statutory right to provide abortion services nationwide, and women would have a corresponding so-called right to abortion. Of course, there's no such thing as a right to kill children, whether they're inside or outside the womb. But the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled in defense of mail order abortion pills that starve a baby to death in the womb and pose an extreme danger to the life and health of the mother as well. Where do you stand in this current pro-life debate about the abortion pills?
Well, I'll tell you that, in my opinion, abortion is murder. Plain and simple, it is murder. And we should stand in every area against it. And this new abortion pill that's been on the market, FDA, quote, approved for about 20 years now, is an absolutely terrible thing because, you know, now you can get it over the counter. I think what the Supreme Court did is they allowed the sale of it to continue until the actual case works its way, the lower court case works its way through the court system. You know, it is my hope and belief that eventually that this drug, and I may not pronounce it right, mifepristone, is eventually banned from sale here in the United States. Every life is precious. And if you look at what our Declaration of Independence says, you know, it talks about unalienable rights given to us by our Creator. And the first one mentioned is life. And governments are there to protect and defend those rights, the right to life, and not to take them. And that's exactly where I stand. And you will see that in every vote I take, that I will protect and defend the Constitution and the right to life. I was there when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, and it was a hallelujah day and a celebration moment. And we just have more to fight, though.
Right. I think we were all there in spirit. Definitely. Wonderful day. But another area, I just have to touch on this because I know we're running short of time, but you've been particularly outspoken, and it's incredible that we have to say this, but it's just a sign of the times. You're one of those who believes that God created man in his own image, male and female. He created them, and there are only two choices. You're born one or the other. You recently voted for the Act to Protect Women and Girls Sports, and despite your best efforts to get a definition of woman from Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, that didn't happen. So what else do you see on the horizon? Any chances we're going to have sanity restored here in our lifetimes?
Yeah, I think there's a chance to have sanity restored. You know, Title IX was put in place in the 1970s to protect women and women's sports and educational opportunities for women, you know, at schools of higher learning. And here we have the education secretary, Miguel Cardona, who doesn't even know how to define a woman. That's what I asked him. How do you define a woman? Because you have to know how to define a woman in order to protect women's sports and women's rights in education. And he obviously doesn't fully understand what that is, or he refuses to. But there are ways that this new rule that they proposed, that they put in place, there are ways to take down this rule, and that's through what's called a limitation amendment in appropriations. And I just happen to be on the Labor HHS Education Subcommittee of Appropriations. And we can do that limitation amendment that basically says that no educational institution that allows biological men to compete in solely women's sports will get federal funding. Now, we can do that. And that then is the counter to what this new proposed rule by Secretary Cardona. And we can defend women's sports. It is unsafe for biological men to be in the private spaces of women, whether it's the locker rooms, the bathrooms, you know, or playing on sports teams against women. I mean, males are physically much stronger on average. So it's an unfair advantage, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen.
Amen. Well, we will be. Let's take the last few seconds here to tell people how they can learn more about you, reach out to you.
Well, they can go to clyde.house.gov. That is the official website for my office in Congress. And you can also reach out to us on Twitter, on Getter, and on Facebook. And I just appreciate the opportunity to serve the people of the 9th Congressional District in Georgia and to be a champion for life and for liberty and for the Second Amendment for the entire folks of the United States.
Amen. Well, you will be in our prayers because you have a tough job when standing up for what's right on Capitol Hill is not for a weakling. And we appreciate you so much. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Rebecca. Good to be with you.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
And to complete today's show, we go to Robert Owens for another installment of Constitution Corner. Today's topic is jury nullification. Let's watch.
Welcome to Constitution Corner. I'm your host, Robert Owens. Follow me on Twitter at RobertOwensJD. And if you appreciate this content, please like and subscribe below, as this simple action advances the message of liberty. For several years, I practiced law. I was counsel to many people who had been indicted by a grand jury and subsequently were tried before a jury tasked with deciding the guilt or innocence of my client. And as any litigator will tell you, going to court is at best a roll of the dice. Now, there's no way to tell, despite the proliferation of professional jury consultants, to predict what a jury will do in any given case. Now, I've personally sat there with my client, convincing him that his innocence was as obvious as anybody who could have heard the evidence, only to have a jury file back into the courtroom and pronounce a guilty verdict. Likewise, I've been certain that my client would be escorted out of the courtroom in cuffs, only to hear not guilty pronounced by the jury foreman. In order for Alvin Bragg to get a conviction against Donald Trump, he will need a unanimous jury to convict. If even one juror holds out, no conviction. Does that one juror even need to have a good reason for holding out for a not guilty verdict? Nope. The why? Because of a doctrine called jury nullification. Jury nullification is the act of a jury finding a person not guilty of charges brought by the government, regardless of the perception of overwhelming evidence. Jury nullification has proven a boon to the falsely accused and a barricade against partisan prosecution. A jury's right to apply the law and not just weigh the facts is well settled in the history of American jurisprudence and has a very distinguished roster of advocates. But before one is able to fully understand why jury nullification is a good idea, one must understand the importance of a trial by jury. Our founding fathers universally considered it to be a powerful weapon in the war against tyranny. In 1789, Thomas Jefferson noted, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution." The potential for jury nullification is an essential check against tyranny. Thus, most of the leading lights of the founding generation considered jury nullification a central plank in the platform of self-government. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton wrote that trial by jury was the very palladium of free government and a valuable check upon corruption. In a 1794 case, Hamilton's fellow Federalist author and Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay informed a jury that, "It may not be amiss here, gentlemen, to remind you of the good old rule that on questions of fact, it is the province of the jury. On questions of law, it is the province of the court to decide. But it must be observed that by the same law which recognizes this reasonable distribution of jurisdiction, you have nevertheless a right to take upon yourselves to judge of both and to determine the law as well as the fact in controversy." Given the strength of these opinions, the founders were adamant that one of the many rights needed to avoid tyranny is the right to a trial by jury. As for the concept of juries, have not only the power, but the obligation to nullify unjust rulings of a judge, one of the early republic's most renowned lawyers, John Adams, wrote, "It is not only the juror's right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court." Hamilton was a practicing attorney at one point and had personal experience with the exercise of unlawful power by judges. In 1804, he argued that juries had a right and a obligation to acquit a defendant if, exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong. As lawyers trained in the 18th century, both Hamilton and Adams would have learned much of their craft from the commentaries on the laws of England, written and compiled between 1765 and 1769 by Sir William Blackstone. On the proper role of juries as a check on government abuse, Blackstone declared, "Every new tribunal erected for the decision of facts without the intervention of a jury is a step towards establishing aristocracy, the most oppressive of absolute governments." In the 1850s, juries in Pennsylvania and other northern states refused to convict Quakers accused of aiding runaway slaves in direct defiance, nullification, of the Fugitive Slave Act. So we can see that the idea that juries may act contrary to the will of a judge has a long and distinguished pedigree in American law. Jury nullification is an act of resistance to government oppression that our founders believed to be fundamental in a republic established upon the principle of equality under the rule of law, rather than upon the arbitrary administration of justice as defined by men. The Constitution guarantees the right to trial by jury, placing upon the government the burden of proving to a jury the legality and morality of charges against individuals, even if the government seeks to deprive the accused of his life, liberty, or property. As indicated by the statements provided, our founding fathers zealously defended this right and recognized that an informed and empowered jury could effectively protect a wrongly accused defendant from potentially harmful effects of autocratic judges and overzealous prosecutors. In defense of the unalienable rights possessed by all men, indeed, as the last line of defense of those rights, jurors can and should reject the government tyranny by refusing to convict those people subjected to prosecution for violating unjust laws or who have broken no law at all. A hearing on motions made by both sides in this case against Donald Trump is scheduled for December 4. Should the case continue to trial, experts estimate that it would begin sometime in the spring of 2024. Don't just know your Constitution, live it.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day, and we will see you tomorrow.